Good evening, and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Ann Madden Rice, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer at the University of California Medical Center in Sacramento, California, and I'll be your moderator for tonight's program. Today's program is generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. You can find the Commonwealth Club at the internet on commonwealthclub.org and the California Healthcare Foundation at the letters chcf.org. Today's discussion will focus on health reform and whether or not California is ready for the changes that will soon take effect. The Affordable Care Act aims to bring health care coverage to approximately one-half to two-thirds of California's 7.3 million uninsured residents. But are we prepared to provide care to the millions that will need access to the system? Will there be enough doctors to care for these new patients? Is our healthcare system set up to meet their needs? This panel will try to answer these questions and more. We have a wonderful set of panelists with us tonight. I'd like to first introduce Janet Hoffman, who is an assistant adjunct professor in the Department of Family and Community Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Kaufman aims to build bridges between academia and policymakers. At the Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies, her work as principal analyst for medical effectiveness for the California Health Benefits Review Program is a prime example of this bridge building. We're also pleased to have Steve McDermott join us tonight. He is the CEO of Hill Physicians Medical Group and the chairman and CEO of PrimeMed Management Services, which has been Hill's exclusive manager since its formation in 1984. Prior to helping start Hill Physicians, Steve was the CEO of MedAmerica, managing hospital-based physicians in California and five other states. Also joining us tonight is Ray Silber. Ralph Silber is the executive director of the Alameda Health Consortium, an association of eight community health centers based in Alameda County. Ralph leads the consortium to achieve comprehensive, accessible health care and improved outcomes for everyone in the county through policy, advocacy, and program activities. So thank you to our panelists for being here tonight. So let's get started. I've got a few questions while you're thinking about the questions that you'd like to ask our panelists. But I'd like to start with Dr. Janet Kaufman and ask, given what's happening in the state to implement the Affordable Care Act, what are California policymakers doing right now to prepare for effective reform in California?
Well, thank you, Anne. I think it's fair to say that California policymakers are doing a number of things. Planning really began in earnest last year, shortly after the Affordable Care Act was enacted and has continued since then. I think I'll touch on three things that I think are among the most important. First is the health insurance exchange. Among the 48 states that did not previously have a health insurance exchange prior to the Affordable Care Act, California was the first to enact legislation to create the exchange, and that was enacted last fall. Since then, five other states have started exchanges. So we're ahead of, I think, other states in that score. The Exchange Board just appointed its fifth and last final member last week, and they've begun to meet in earnest and hire a staff and really shape the exchange with the goal of having it ready before 2014 to begin enrolling people. And again, the health insurance exchange is primarily for those who have been in the individual insurance market or small group market, and is a way to pool those people and to better negotiate better health plans and also to provide subsidies to make coverage more affordable. Secondly, in the realm of Medi-Cal, the state last fall obtained a waiver from the Federal Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services to do a number of things, including establishing a low-income health program that will, prior to 2014, begin enrolling low-income adults who have previously had great difficulty obtaining coverage. And then thirdly, in terms of the health workforce, you know, the physicians, nurses, and other health professionals who will be needed to provide care to the newly insured, last fall the state established a health workforce development council that is assessing the state's needs and making plans for addressing them, particularly in the area of primary care, where the state already has a short supply of providers.
Thank you, Dr. Kaufman. With the Accountable Care Act, there are a lot of new terms that we're hearing, and I'd like to direct this to Steve McDermott. So, Steve, there's been a lot of talk about team-based care, patient-centered medical homes, and accountable care organizations, among others. Can you explain some of these changes, and what are providers doing here in California to prepare for these new approaches to delivering care?
The move towards coordinated care, team care, and accountable care is something actually that's been pioneered here in California for the past 20, 25, 30 years. Kaiser began, with it after World War II. Class of 47 minted that program, but it was basically a closed system. And actually, when I was forming Hill 30 years ago, 28 years ago, it was to actually create a coordinated, accountable regional delivery system, building on independent physicians. I saw the value of the Kaiser model, but that was a closed model, and there were lots of independent doctors in the independent hospitals. I would have to say that I was a very young man at the time. I was probably 18 years old, and so it was a bit ahead of the time. But the delegated model in California is very alive and well. There's about 6-7 million people, in addition to the Kaiser population. There's about 6 or 7 million people in California that are covered by these accountable care organizations, term in the legislation, the health reform legislation, called accountable care organizations, was actually built on the California model, and it was Now, that said, pulling that off outside of California, beginning from scratch with independent doctors on a fee-for-service system, is going to be tough going. We use capitation here, and we've had a lot of experience doing it. So I would say that in that respect, having fallen by the wayside, particularly during the Bush administration, California is back in the news and back in the vanguard in terms of the right thing to do in healthcare, in building these coordinated team-based systems, accountable care systems, population health, prevention, and whatnot. And we stretched ourselves probably in the early 90s by doing a lot of things, jumping ahead of ourselves a little bit. And I think we're going at this time 2.0, if you will, meaning more mature, more sophisticated, with a layer of pay-for-performance layered on top. So we're actually measuring with public report cards the quality and the cost efficiency programs that competing with each other. Maybe a little later I'll talk a little bit about the experience that we have in Sacramento with CalPERS, where we've actually reversed the premium trend and brought it down to actually zero, and having very good success by reducing, doing much more pre-hospital work, better planning, better breaking down the silos that have existed between doctors, hospitals, insurance companies, and providing more coordinated and care and better handoffs, which CalPERS says is not only reduced costs but actually had very strong benefits to the patients who have seen better service and better care to them.
Thanks, Steve. And then, Ralph, I'd like to turn to you. Given your role in Alameda County and your familiarity with the state of California, you have a lot of experience with community health centers. Now, community health centers and other safety net providers have traditionally borne a disproportionate burden in caring for uninsured patients. As more Californians have access to health insurance, what do you think the role on some of the safety net providers might be?
Thanks. You know, I thought I'd start by just putting out some of the numbers that we're talking about in terms of the number of people. So there's about 7 million uninsured Californians today. The best numbers we have from UCLA are about 2.1 million of those people will qualify for Medi-Cal in 2014, assuming that the folks in Washington don't change their mind about this program. So that's about 2 million additional people put into our current state-run program for low-income people. An additional 1.7 million uninsured Californians will be eligible to purchase health insurance through the exchange that's been mentioned, and those folks will be eligible for some amount of public subsidy, trying to bring the price of buying that insurance a little bit lower and a little bit more affordable. About 1.2 million Californians will have the opportunity to purchase insurance through the exchange, but without any subsidy, because their incomes are over 400% of the poverty level. If they can afford it, they'll have a better opportunity than they have today to buy coverage. In the best case scenario, assuming that the legislation is not destroyed at the federal level, assuming all the people I just talked about either receive free coverage or subsidized coverage or full pay for their coverage, we'll still have over a million Californians, most of whom, because of their immigration status, won't qualify for any coverage at all. And in spite of the legislation's effort to make health insurance more affordable, I feel pretty confident that we'll still have hundreds of thousands of Californians who won't be able to afford coverage. So I just think that's sort of one reference point. On the one hand, we're talking about millions of additional people having some coverage, but also probably still millions of Californians without coverage. In terms of what we're doing right now, one of the things we're trying to do is that there's about 900,000 people in California who are eligible for Medi-Cal today, but who are not enrolled in the program because I don't know if there's anyone in the room who's ever tried to apply for Medi-Cal. It's a fairly difficult process. I say if you take your college application and your home mortgage application and your life insurance application and roll all those things together, that's what your experience is like applying for Medi-Cal. So one of the contributions we're trying to make is trying to get everyone who is currently eligible onto the program. And then, as been mentioned, basically California got permission from the federal government to start some of these expansions of insurance coverage earlier. So actually, July 1st, is that Friday? Mm-hmm. Friday, most of the counties in California will start enrolling some low-income people into a sort of modified insurance program. And hopefully, we're talking about this magic switch on January 1st, 2014, when the Medi-Cal expansion goes in place. Hopefully, having a good chunk of those 2 million people who become newly eligible already sort of in the system, so we can flip the switch and they'll actually have their insurance in reality effective on that day. I think the other thing that we're all trying to do, I think, is figure out a better way to provide health care. The shortage of primary care providers has already been spoken to, and there's no way we're ever going to have enough physicians to provide care the way we do now for all of these newly eligible people. So I think something Steve's talked about, accountable care organizations and care coordination, we're all involved in trying to figure out more efficient ways, whether that's through use of technology, use of phone visits, group visits, having people see health educators, seeing other kinds of providers. But I think the only chance we have to actually make this real is to change how we provide care and, quite honestly, to try to lower the cost of providing care, because even with this reform in place, the cost of health care in the United States is really skyrocketing and I think is unsustainable.
Thanks, Ralph. We're getting some very insightful questions from our audience, so I'd like to turn to some of those. And I'll leave this up to any of the panelists who would care to respond. The questions are the people, the patients, who will gain health care coverage under the Affordable Care Act medically different than those who already have insurance? And also, will this influx of new people, new customers, place disproportionate pressure on any specific medical services? Any thoughts about that question?
Well, I'll take a bit at that. There are the group that Ralph mentioned at UCLA has been doing some work to try to look at the characteristics of the people who would be newly eligible for coverage under the Affordable Care Act, both for coverage through the exchange and through Medi-Cal. And I think it's fair to say that for the most part, the people who would be eligible for coverage under the exchange look a lot like people who have group insurance coverage through their employers today. And those who would be eligible for Medi-Cal in general are pretty similar. A few exceptions on the Medi-Cal side would be higher rates of hypertension, overweight, and smoking. Those are clearly important because they're risk factors for chronic disease over the lifespan. So that is indeed a very good question. I don't know at this point that we know enough to say that there would be disproportionate burden on any particular service, but given the risk profile, probably not.
Yep. Yeah, we agree.
Okay, good. Another question that's somewhat related to this is the question is, we spend huge amounts of money on health care, and Ralph, you referred to some of the high health care costs, yet collectively we're not that healthy. What can we do about this, and what about preventative care? How can we get everyone to lead healthier lifestyles so fewer people get sick and our insurance premiums go down?
Yeah, Ralph.
I'll take care of that, too. One of the things that's in the health care reform bill is something called the Public Health Trust Fund. There's actually an allocation of several billion dollars. Again, I told Steve before this, I try to restrain myself from talking too much about politics, but I'm sure people know from reading the paper that many components of the health care reform bill are threatened in Washington. And this includes the public health funding. But right now there is funding for something called community transformation programs, which are an attempt at the community level to get at these kinds of issues. So trying to advance the work that California has already done in terms of tobacco control, reducing the number of people who smoke, trying to address issues about access to healthy food, access to exercise. So there is a sizable amount of funding that is available under the federal health care bill to try to help communities on a community-wide basis, whether people are insured or uninsured, change people's lives in the communities so that people are eating healthier food, exercising more, and smoking less. So there is an attempt. You know, the bill tried, and this may have actually been one of the things that's made the bill vulnerable, the bill tried to address a lot of different parts of the problem. Mm-hmm. So there's parts of the bill that looked at training more people to be primary care doctors. Obviously, a big part of it is giving people more health insurance. But this issue of we've got to make people healthier, there is an attempt in the bill to try to address that.
Steve, did you want to add to that?
Well, you know that we've not changed the number very much over the last 30 or 40 years. It's about 1.5% of the total funding of health care is on prevention, which is ridiculous. And we spend, as you may know, way too much at the other end of life, you know, beyond hope. The thing I've been thinking about, what I've actually been doing is chairing, when I chair the pay-for-performance program in California, what I've sort of looked forward to is a time when there will be this group of accountable care organizations that are going to be, how are we going to hold them accountable? And what I would like to see built in is a public report card on how all the money that we spend on medical care is actually contributing to the health of Californians. And we're building that report card, and I think it's still going to take us 5-10 years at least to get there. But really, what's the return on investment of the tremendous amounts of money, I mean, that we're spending every year on the the cultural health and social fabric of the state of California.
Good. Thanks, Steve. We're starting to get a number of questions about primary care, so I'd like to move a little bit more deeply into that area. One of the questions has to do with that there are, and we've all read them, projections about the deficit in the number of primary care physicians. And this question is interested, this questioner is interested in learning more about what parts of the federal law incentives address students going into primary care. And a related question is how is the law in California in particular addressing primary care physicians other than allopathic physicians such as chiropractors, acupuncturists, and others? Okay. So I think if maybe someone would comment on kind of the workforce issues around delivering primary care.
Okay, sure. I will try to do that. I think the Affordable Care Act does several things that are aimed at increasing the supply of primary care providers. One thing in particular is expansion of the National Health Service Corps. Again, and that was actually building on expansions in the stimulus bill. The National Health Service Corps, for those of you that are not familiar with it, is a program that provides scholarships and or loan repayment to primary care providers, and not just physicians. It includes nurse midwives, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants, and also mental health and professionals and dentists. And the idea is providing financial support for education in exchange for professionals going out and practicing in underserved communities, either inner cities or rural areas, for a length of time after they've completed their training. And the National Health Service Corps was one of the few workforce programs for which funds were actually appropriated in the Act. Now, it's still possible that those could be called back, but that's in a little better shape than some of the other workforce programs where the funding was merely authorized. So I think the National Health Service Corps is particularly important one for students. There are also efforts to continue and expand funding for primary care residency programs in medicine, and also funding for nurse practitioner education. Those, however, have really suffered in the appropriations process. Another thing I'll say in terms of incentives has to do with reimbursement. We pay in this country significantly more to specialists to treat people who've had heart attacks and stroke than we pay primary care providers and public health professionals to figure out how to help people avoid heart attacks and strokes. And this is particularly evident, is evident across the board, but where the federal government has policy levers is in Medicare and Medicaid, Medicare being the program for the elderly, and Medicaid, which we call Medi-Cal in California, for low-income persons. And in Medicare is already starting to give a 10% bonus to primary care providers. That went into effect in January of this year and will continue for till 2015. So that's an attempt to increase reimbursement for primary care providers taking care of people in Medicare. The Act sets aside money in 2013 and 2014 to raise payment rates for primary care physicians in Medicaid, Medi-Cal in California, to Medicare rates. And what does that mean? Well, here in California, we have the dubious distinction of having some of the lowest, if not the lowest, Medi-Cal provider rates in the country. We pay people like Ralph's providers horribly to take care of people on Medi-Cal. And so raising those rates to Medicare will certainly increase reimbursement. So these are steps, but I would say they're still fairly modest steps, and they're poised to end in 2014 and 2015 unless the federal government is willing, you know, Congress is willing to provide additional resources. So steps in the right direction, but probably not nearly as far as we need to go to make primary care more rewarding and alleviate the shortage.
Thanks, Janet. We've had some good commentary on primary care and some of the aspects of the delivery system. I'd like to turn now to some of the financing issues. both federally and at the level, the state level. Can you provide some insight on how the new care will be financed, some of the provisions of the Accountable Care Act in California and the healthcare exchange to bring services to approximately 7 million people that perhaps have been underserved in the past?
You know, the challenge is that both our state and federal governments are in very bad financial shape. So, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking, do you know something we don't know
in
that question?
Just the moderator.
Probably among the three of us, we could reach back in our memories and what's actually in the bill about how it's going to be financed. Mm-hmm. And that is technically still the law of the land. But California has already passed and will soon enact significant reductions mm-hmm. in the Medi-Cal program. So you've already heard about the low reimbursement. Starting in the fall, essentially all Medi-Cal providers are going to be cut by 10%. There's going to be a limit of seven physician visits a year if you're on Medi-Cal in California. So we have sort of two different planes of reality here. The bill that was passed in Washington does have financing mechanisms. It has reductions in the growth of Medicare. It has various new tax revenues. But that reality is in my mind overshadowed. I just talked about Sacramento. I'm sure people in this room read the paper. There's a huge battle going on in Washington about lifting the debt limit. And I think there's no doubt that part of the package agreement to lift the debt limit will be a significant reduction in the federal financing for Medicaid. So I think the financing of the program is in serious doubt because of the situation both in Washington. And, you know, one of the reasons I started by saying how many people are supposed to be added to Medi-Cal in the program is because that is the biggest chunk of people. I mean, the program is really – the federal health care reform is really built on the backbone of the Medi-Cal program, which is underfunded to begin with, is about to be cut at the state level, and is about to be cut at the federal level. So, you know, I think we're all sort of doing what we're supposed to try to get ready. But there is a financial reality thing that I think is going to hit us soon that's really going to question our collective ability to pull this off.
Thanks, Ralph. As some of these payment cuts take place, do any of you perceive impacts on things such as access to appointments for patients, perhaps wait times to have a procedure done or to see a physician, or any changes in what patients expect for level of service?
There's two ways to answer that. The first is it will be spots, right? You know, it's going to be depends on where you live and you know, so there'll be certain urban environments that will have a tougher time. So, you know, you have to think about the demographics. I think the Central Valley is going to be facing a hard time because of the large unemployed situation there. And it's already tough going in Central Valley in terms of just today finding a physician and access. The other side of the coin, though, is that, and back to the primary care model and fee-for-service, I mean, we're not doing a good job today of servicing and providing access and whatnot, mm-hmm. let alone this overhang that's about to come. We have to, Ralph said it earlier, we have to come up with a different way of doing what we're doing because what we're doing costs too much and it delivers too little. And primary care physicians on a fee-for-service basis seeing 30 patients a day is crazy. I mean, who ever thought? It doesn't work for the patient. It doesn't work for the doctor. I mean, we just have to change that model. I've been doing some work with in London with National Health Service and in the Netherlands, and they really have built the primary care home, and they make it work. And it's a team. Mm-hmm. And it's nutritionists, it's social workers, and, you know, and some things being done in, like, Trenton, New Jersey here, and, you know, are really building out programs, you know, that deliver collectively what we're trying to deliver mm-hmm. in 8 minutes of FaceTime with a doctor who increasingly is looking down at his, you know, his computer.
Mm-hmm.
And I just would add, Steve, I think that while other countries definitely are far ahead of the United States on team-based care, that there are certainly efforts afoot in California to implement and make the team model work, looking also at things like group visits, email visits. So I guess I'd say I think that there are promising innovations out there, but we're still nowhere where it's still going to be a big struggle.
Yeah, no, we helped pioneer the group visits about 7, 8, 10 years ago, and I was actually quite amazed. If you haven't participated in them, we first did them for example, and let's just take that as an isolated instance. We thought maybe we'd try it for, you know, disease-specific. Well, then we found out that it didn't matter. You just got people together, and guess what? They started talking to each other, and, oh, by the way, they didn't feel isolated and alone and dependent, and they felt more empowered. And, oh, by the way, maybe the traditional doctor-patient relationship isn't particularly the right way to approach things for at least particularly chronic disease. What an amazing breakthrough. And so, but the underlying fee-for-service payment model in the United mm-hmm. States drives the dominant thinking, mm-hmm. and that's what we have to change.
Do you think the emergence of bundled health care payments would be one approach to changing that mindset?
If it's a step away from fee-for-service to bundling, that's a step in the right direction, but it falls far short of what you really have to do, which is much more programmatic. Because we still haven't figured out if you bundled the payment whether we should have done the thing in the first place. Yes, I did need that hip replacement, but I don't think I needed a whole bunch of other things they said I needed.
Steve, you mentioned that the impact might vary by what part of the state you live in or what part of the country you live in. Can you be more specific, or can anyone else maybe discuss what would it be like for a rural clinic, for example?
Okay, well, I think that's a great question. And I think what we know based on the data we have on certainly primary care provider supply in California is that our rural and inner city areas face the greatest shortages of physicians, and that in our rural areas we also have large numbers of doctors who are at or near retirement age. So it's not at all clear that all of them are going to be in place in 2014. And these areas struggle not just with recruiting physicians, but also with recruiting nurse practitioners, physician assistants, dentists, mental health providers. We continue to have an ongoing crisis in getting health professionals in rural areas. So I think while healthcare reform, if it's enacted, and I'm still hopeful that we'll go forward, we will have more people in those areas with health insurance, but I think there are big challenges to getting adequate numbers of primary care providers of any stripe to provide them with the services they need and in whatever model we might come up with.
Thank you, Ms. Janet. Changing the cost structure was mentioned earlier, and spending more for preventive services so that we can spend less on chronic disease management and end-of-life decisions. Another aspect is not just how much health care we use, but the price of inputs. So the question we've received is, are you familiar with or have you an opinion on the Japanese-influenced Sensei model of increased hospital efficiency? It's sometimes called the Toyota Production Method or Lean Six Sigma. Any thoughts about techniques or approaches to reducing the price of the individual inputs in addition to how much care we actually consume?
The prices on the inputs, I think you're mixing a little apple and orange, but it's close. The prices on the inputs have more to do with labor costs in the United States compared to most of the other Western industrialized countries. We spend so our labor costs run, I think the number was something like 35-40% higher than European countries. And sometimes, by the way, our utilization numbers aren't as high. So it definitely is a price-driven cost of inputs model. So, for example, Canada notoriously has fewer MRIs and there's a waiting list. But in Europe, they actually use hospitals as much or more than we do. It's just that the cost of running the hospital isn't anything near what it costs to run hospitals in this country. There's also a difference between prices and cost. I would say sometime in the past, maybe 20 years ago, there was not much connection between price and cost, but they have caught up with each other, and price has sort of pulled the cost along and affects decisions internally. So let me just give you an example. I hate to do this in a radio, but pop quiz to the radio audience. What's a one-day stay in a hospital in the Bay Area, price-wise? Well, I see the hands raised in the audience, and it runs around $25,000 to $30,000 a night. That's the price. And if you're uninsured, just to get to that, that's the bill you will get. And now when a hospital bills out that kind of number, the average length of stay in a hospital is around 2.5-3 days. So do the math. It's $75,000 for a stay in a hospital. And if you then are talking about those kind of prices, then your costs start to become, hey, my costs are only $10,000 a night. So, I'm saving, I'm less than 50. It's ridiculous. All right. So, it's interesting. We've gotten so far away. I speak to audiences more internal to the industry. And when I'll ask the question, what is a one-night stay in a hospital, it's astonishing to me how few people in our industry even know what that is, or how much are employees losing out of their wages for the insurance premiums that they're paying. We've lost disconnect there. And then how much is that total pie of healthcare, causing education funds and basic infrastructure and research, and we talked about prevention, it's just pushing everything out of the way. And as you said, it's causing our bond rating to be at risk in the guy. I mean, it's just at some point you say the medical industry, individually, they're all trying to do the right thing, but collectively it's become a burden that we have to change.
Yeah, just for those of you who have access to the New York Times, there's actually an article today about these new hip replacements that turned out really weren't such a good idea, and I think it's a really good microcosm that we've allowed health, in the course of my lifetime, we've allowed healthcare to become part of the for-profit economy of the United States. And you look at the introduction of medical devices and many pharmaceuticals, the standard we have for demonstrating that something's of value is incredibly low. And one of the things we saw in the healthcare reform debate was essentially a backlash against the notion that somebody with some objectivity should look at a new device or a new pharmaceutical and say, wow, is this really useful? And it's a little hard to run the system in a cost-effective manner if we have no consensus in this country that there's any test of whether something is worth doing. So I think those are increasing forces that make it really hard to make care affordable if we just think that anything that anybody comes up with should be available, even when there's no proof it improves the quality of people's lives. It makes it really hard, just to feel sorry for ourselves. For those of us who are trying to make the system better, it's this tidal wave of new things that cost a lot of money, and there's often very little proof it helps people's lives.
Janet, I think your center gets involved in comparative effectiveness research. Would you care to share a little bit about new work that is being done on comparative effectiveness?
Sure. And I think this is certainly, to echo what Ralph said, I think been controversial. You may recall the death panels from the debate, and what that really, in that case, really stemmed from was efforts to reimburse physicians to actually talk to people about who with terminal illnesses about their options. And from that, death panels, I think, has spun out a lot of concern about what I think was a very well-intentioned part of the act, and that is the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, or PCORI. And the idea behind that was to support researchers in doing comparative effectiveness research. And what do I mean by comparative effectiveness research? Well, this is research to compare different treatment options. So Ralph mentioned the New York Times article about the metal hip, the metal hips for hip replacement. So in that case, an example of comparative effectiveness, well, let's compare a metal to a ceramic to our other options. Let's try to do some research to figure out which of these hip replacement implants works best and for whom. And similarly work on looking at that for prescription drugs, and also a call to go beyond looking at drugs and devices to looking at different models of care. What's the evidence that group visits are more effective than the traditional physician visit? What are the effects of a team? I think there's a lot of optimism in that. There certainly was funding through the stimulus bill. So I think I'm encouraged. But interestingly, in the legislation, there was language specifically saying that cost can't be taken into consideration.
Sort of like you're going to go buy a house or a car, but one factor you can't look at is what's it going to cost.
Exactly.
I guess my wife.
Well, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services and will be responsible for overseeing a lot of how the Affordable Care Act actually takes shape, and I know that they're interested in comparative effectiveness.
Sure.
They're also interested in the use of technology, particularly the electronic health record. Any thoughts about how that might change how the Affordable Health Care Act is implemented in the state of California?
They're probably not connected in the short run because it's the short run. In fact, hopefully the insurance exchanges will be up and running, and we'll still be trying to implement the electronic health record. when I'm dead and buried, it's really tough slugging. To implement the electronic health record in any kind of organized way requires organized delivery systems. So it's a little bit of a catch-22. Mm-hmm. Meaning you can put them in doctors' offices, but unless they're really connected to each other in a way that you can systematize and build programs around them, and data mine, and to create effectiveness, it's and it's odd, by the way, as mentioned, in Europe they all have electronic medical records, but they don't do much with it because nobody's connected. So
thanks, Steve. I do want to talk I want to give you a chance to comment on the California Insurance Exchange and some of the political issues, but before I do, I want to take just a very brief time out for people who have just tuned in on the radio to remind you that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today's discussion focuses on health reform and whether or not California is ready for the changes that are taking effect in California due to the passage of the Affordable Care Act. Our panelists this evening are Janet Kaufman, Assistant Adjunct Professor in the Department of Family and Community Medicine at UCSF, Steve McDermott, CEO of Hill Physicians Medical Group, and the chairman and CEO of PrimeMed Management Services, and Ralph Silber, executive director of the Alameda Health Consortium, and I'm Ann Madden Rice, chief executive officer of the University of California Davis Medical Center. So let's turn to the health exchange. I think it was mentioned earlier that California is somewhat of an early adopter in terms of moving to an exchange to offer access to insurance products and a way to compare those insurance products easily for consumers. Could someone bring us up to date on really where the exchange is today and what's happened?
Well, I would say that they're getting started. It took some time to get all five members of the board appointed. I think largely because of very strict conflict of interest standards. So the fifth member has been appointed. The board has had several meetings and is in the process of hiring staff. and I'm taking much of what I'm saying here from a presentation that Kim Belshe, who's one of the board members, gave at a conference a couple weeks ago. And I think that they, you know, have their work ahead of them, but have a really ambitious agenda, but are hoping to get the exchange up and running early. One thing that I think is really important to point out about our exchange in California is that the legislation authorized the exchange to negotiate with health plans on behalf of the persons participating in the exchange. And the reason that that's important is that that's really pooling the purchasing power, that it goes beyond something like e-health insurance where you can put in your profile and get a bunch of rate quotes. I mean, that's maybe a little useful, it gives you a little of information, but it doesn't give you bargaining power. When you're an individual person or an individual family and you're going up against a health plan, you don't have much bargaining power, and if you're sick, you really don't have bargaining power. And so by the idea of the act of purchasing is pooling people and negotiating on their behalf, much as employers do in negotiating with health plans for coverage for their employees. I think the second thing that the exchange really envisions is standardizing the policies. In other words, making it easy to compare health plan. If you've ever looked at something like e-health insurance, it's not that easy because we have, particularly in this state, an individual market without a lot of standardization. So just enabling people to make, by having standardized information, to make more informed choices about their coverage. You can think of this very much as any of you have Part B Medicare, similar to the standardized policies that are for supplemental coverage there, so that you know when you're comparing. And can make a choice about what's best for you.
Thanks, Janet. There are some restrictions on how products are going to be priced in the exchange, as I understand it. What are the incentives for insurance companies to market through the exchange?
Well, I think, Steve, if you want to see. I think in California, one of the federal government, is that the rules for coverage in the individual insurance market will be the same inside and outside the exchange. That's a big distinction between the small business purchasing cooperative we had in California some years ago. And what do I mean by that? Meaning that all insurers, whether you're selling the product inside the exchange or outside the exchange, you're going to have guaranteed issue. You're going to have to cover people who apply, and you're going to have to renew them. You're also going you're going to be limited in what factors you can use in setting rates. You're going to only be limited to things such as age, sex, geographic location, and whether people smoke. So I think in terms of what I'd say is it may not be so much incentives as removing disincentives by leveling the rules. And potentially if large enough numbers of people are interested in signing up for the exchange, you know, there's the question of, well, are you going to play ball or walk away from a considerable segment of the market?
Right. That's and for the insurance companies, not all the health plans are in that market, and so the plans that have been in that market are really in a good position to make it work. They have experience with it. Some of them have been taking a hit in the newspapers for the rates increases that they've been doing. But unfortunately, it's not the health plan. It's the, as I've been saying, it's the underlying cost structure that they're just insuring. I think the point you're making, by the way, the standardization process, right, mm-hmm. the homogenization process of the exchange is really important long term, and the transparency of it as well. Okay. It will help greatly clean up the insurance mess that we have now in the state, maybe in 4 or 5 years, but I think it's a really good step in the right direction.
Do any of the aspects of that standardization mirror what might occur in a single payer system?
Well, you know, if you achieve the standard, that's actually what I was speaking to. If you achieve that kind of standardization, transparency, you will narrow down the number of insurance companies. There are a lot of players on the fringe right now taking advantage of people in part of the market which is not terribly regulated under the DOI. And again, back to Europe, they've had good experience of both the single payer and of nonprofit health insurance companies doing it as well, the Netherlands, for example. So it's not necessarily one single solution.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Steve. The exchange will take a couple of years to get going, and it'll be a few years before we see a large increase in the number of people that are insured. What kinds of policies is California pursuing to make sure that our existing system is stable until we make that transition?
Well, we've already lost that one.
Yeah.
I was going to use a word that I shouldn't use in public. I mean, it's what I said before, because of the financial situation, the financial underpinning of the Medi-Cal program is really threatened. But I think in the meantime, the community health centers that I represent, the public hospital systems, you know, we're doing everything we can to serve more and more people, and often with less and less money. California, in addition to being a forerunner on the exchange, California has been in the forefront in taking every option available under the federal bill to expand coverage sooner rather than later. Now, how that will survive in the financial situation we're in now is unclear, but you got to say that so far, if we think the governor and legislature haven't done so well in the budget, on these health care issues, California has really been in the lead nationwide. So if I want to look for something positive, there has been a fair amount of consensus in Sacramento about trying to take advantage of every possible opportunity that has been put forth under the bill.
Thanks, Ralph.
But I think, Steve? To your question, it's a fallacy to think that the current system is stable or even can be maintained. Mm-hmm. It's going – so absent health care reform that's on the table, then something else has to come to fix it, because it's broken and it's not going to get repaired on its own.
You know, I think that's a really important point, that we shouldn't think the federal bill is just about providing health insurance for people who are not insured. I mean, I think I'm an insured person. I assume many people in the room are insured. I completely agree with Steve. The system we have, left to its own devices, will implode. I shared this with a couple of the speakers before we started. Someone in my office made the mistake of giving me our Kaiser bill for our own employees to sign. I'm sure there's till now been a conspiracy for me not to see it. We're a relatively small nonprofit organization. We have employees who we're paying $20,000 a year for their Kaiser coverage. I mean, it's just sort of hit home for me. I think your point about not knowing that a hospital stay costs $20,000, it was an eye-opening experience for me, even though this is what I do for a living. You know, I think for all of us, the cost trajectory that we're on is completely unsustainable. And again, there are elements in the bill that they were able to get in that are designed to try to get us on some kind of path that brings down the price point for all of us.
Ralph, I'd like to follow up on the points you've made about relatively small employers or smaller-sized employers. Do you think that there's a high likelihood that they will choose to participate in the exchange, or will they look at some of the tax incentives and perhaps not continue to offer the coverage that they've historically offered?
I hate to make gross generalizations, but I think there are many small employers who want to do the right thing, many of whom have struggled for many years to provide coverage. I think increasingly what's happening, and we see this in our health centers, is people come into the health center and they have some kind of insurance, and I think Steve's alluded to this, there's a lot of really junky policies out there. And again, one of the things the exchange could offer is just better rationalizing the current system.
Right. Mm-hmm.
People think they have insurance and they find out, oh, yeah, you have a $5,000 deductible, or I actually tried to buy a I tried to buy coverage for my son before the 26-year-old thing, right? I'm a beneficiary of the bill. My son is now covered because of that. You know, and this is my business. I've done it for 25 years, and I call an unnamed one of the two blues and had a conversation about the coverage. And I'm listening to this person explain to me, you know, like, oh, is there pharmacy coverage? Oh, you can go to Walmart and get those $4 prescriptions. It is. Mm-hmm. That's a reasonable choice. Mm-hmm. But she was trying to present to me that that was part of the policy. And then I said, well, do you cover office visits? Oh, yes, 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 we cover office visits. And after 20 minutes, what I found out is that the negotiated price that this Blue Shield had with physicians was available to me to pay out of my pocket by signing up for this policy mm-hmm. that had a huge deductible. But she was offering to me great deal. The physician visits were covered because I had access to their price list instead of the full price mm-hmm. list. So I think just getting people better information right. about better policies would be a
right.
big
and
step
also, in the thing I forgot to mention, just setting standards for policies. The federal government will be setting standards for what are the minimum essential health benefits that the health plans in the exchange have to cover and levels of coverage. So I think the goal there is to ensure that people have comprehensive coverage for the things they need, and so that it's health insurance that's really, you know,
real,
that's really going to protect you when you have a catastrophic illness. And unfortunately, as both Ralph and Steve said, there's just right now in the individual market a lot of junk out there that people actually would probably be better off not buying some of those policies and putting the money in a savings account.
We've covered a lot of good ground on the California Health Exchange. I'd like to move to some of the political issues now. And one of the observations that I've made from some of your comments is that California is ahead of the curve in a number of ways, but we're reading about other states that do not seem to be embracing the Accountable Care Act. And any thoughts about if there were to be federal changes in the law, what would if part of the law were to be repealed, for example, would California stay the course with some of the changes that it's made so much progress on, or do you think it would abandon some of those efforts?
I think we'll stay the course on the system issue. You know, we started this project with CalPERS and Blue Shield up in Sacramento 3 years ago before the health reform law was on the books, before we knew what an accountable care organization was. And it's something that we're helping to promote far and wide because it's just and I think that the providers, when I say the system's broke, everybody working in it, just about everybody working in it, knows it's broken. They want a better solution. I mean, nobody's happy. The patient's not happy. The doctor's not happy. I mean, and it's just not a productive way of providing care. And the Accountable Care Organization, or the model of team-based primary care-centered, patient-centered care is really taking hold. However, the big elephant in the room is Medicare and federal funding and what the feds do to Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And so if this thing does start to fall apart or gets watered down more than it already is, it will set things back. And mm-hmm. this is not a pretty picture. It's not a pretty picture today for too many people, and it's going to get worse if we don't get it, if we don't start turning it around.
I was just going to add that the degree of politicization, whatever that word is it's really astounding. The person that President Obama wanted to appoint to be the head of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services is not going to be confirmed by Congress. This person is, I think by most of us in the business, mm-hmm. maybe the most highly regarded person who's devoted his career to try to improve the quality of care. And because of, I guess, some Republican concern about something that's always been a little unclear to me, he will serve what is legally entitled to 1 year term without congressional approval, and then he will be out. So we're talking about the politicization not only of sort of what do we cover and how do we pay for it, but at the individual level, and it just makes it.
You know, the one of the things that I didn't expect when I get involved in healthcare, because I started on the emergency medical end of it, you know, and never thought I'd end up way over here, is that it's a picture of the United States and the issues that we have. And what this person's being accused of is being a socialist. And if you and if you think about the things we're talking about, and the interdependency that we're talking about of team-based medicine just within medical care, and then the interdependency of all of us collectively to sort of work together to cover each other, yeah, it sounds socialistic, guilty. And is it the right thing to do? Absolutely. And so there is this ideology, and I'm really glad to see it come to a head. Let's vote on this and decide. And, you know, those states that want to, for some reason, I feel bad for them because I don't want them to go that way. But if they want it to be every man for themselves, every person for themselves, and no safety net, and, you know, it's kind of, I hope we don't go that way, but I prefer to America address this straight up and deal with it.
We're getting close to the end of our time, so I'd like to ask each of the panelists to comment on one final question. We've talked a lot about the difficulties that we're having with the system, but I don't know that we've talked as much as we can about what would success look like if we achieved it. And so I'd like you to envision maybe 10 years from now, 2021, if your wish list came true and the Accountable Care Act could accomplish the things that you think are most important, what would those most important elements have been, and how would you know success if you saw it?
A greatly reduced amount of U.S. spending on reactive medical care, total amount compressed, and that amount of money spent on prevention, health and wellness programs, and education, and that collectively that we started to begin to accrue the benefits of those kinds of programs as a society. Is that going to be caught on radio?
Can you be a little more specific, though, about benefits? What benefits do you think we should be placing the highest priority on achieving?
People being more active, more engaged with each other, and so we have a healthier body politic that translates into healthier people, healthier kids, that we care for each other and we all acknowledge we need to live together and work together and play together. That we become, we come together. We've come apart. You all know this, the statistics. I mean, my God, the difference in the haves and the have-nots in this country over the last 20 or 30 years, the numbers are terrible. We've lost our middle class. So, you know, the 1% of Americans have 20% of the income? 25? Thank you. And it used to be in the 50s and early 60s, it used to be 9%. And, that's just not right.
Janet, did you want to comment on because you've got
– I'm sorry.
Your center might have some thoughts about that you'd like to –
You know, what does success – well, I think what Steve's pointing out is that this is broader, way broader than health insurance. If we want to look just in the context of expansion of access to health insurance, well, success there looks like getting, if not everybody, almost everybody covered. And that's important. You know, healthcare should not bankrupt people.
Right.
And it shouldn't be something that where you work and whether you work is what dictates whether you're going to have coverage and how good it's going to be. So I think that's tremendously important. But I think what Steve and Rafa said is it doesn't stop there. That just giving people coverage to get care through a broken medical care system isn't enough. We need to transform the medical care system, and we need to, I think what I take Steve to be saying is we need to transform our own society to be a society where we are looking out for one another's physical, mental, well-being, and where we, and I would add to that that we also have a society where beyond medical care, we do the things in the community that can help people to lead healthier lives.
Exactly. Thank you. And Ralph, we'll leave the last minute to you if you have anything that you'd like to add to that.
I thought it was all very well said, and I agree. I would just say on a personal note, I suffer from chronic lower back pain. And one of the things I would want is a system that really, I mean, you know, I'm well educated, I'm in the business, I'm insured, I speak English. It's really hard to figure out how to get what I need for what is, I don't know, maybe the first or second most common problem that people mm-hmm. present in the healthcare system. So, you know, I think what Steve and Jadot are saying is the most important thing. But I think even for those problems where there is a sort of medical intervention, the system doesn't work very well. I mean, now I'm kicking myself after you said the thing about the hospital stay. I've had two MRIs in the last 90 days. And probably, yeah, exactly.
And you're still not cured.
Funny how that is. $6,000 worth of advanced diagnostics later, and my back still hurts. You know, I could have gotten a lot of chiropractic and physical therapy visits for those $6,000 worth of MRIs.
Well, I'd like to thank all of our panelists this evening for sharing their thoughts and insights with us. Janet Kaufman, Assistant Adjunct Professor in the Department of Family and Community Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Steve McDermott, CEO of Hill Physicians Medical Group, and the Chairman and CEO of PrimeMed Management Services, Ralph Silber, Executive Director of the Alameda Health Consortium. And I'd also like to thank the audience here and on the radio. We received some truly insightful questions from the audience, so thank you for those. This program was generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. My name is Ann Madden Rice, and now this meeting of the California Club, Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you.
And-